very warm welcome and thank you for tuning in to the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group podcast. If you've joined us before, we hope you've returned because you're enjoying the series. If this is your first time, we're glad you found us and there are lots more episodes for you to catch up on. My name is Helga McFarlane and with me as always is Julie Jones. It's usually Julie you hear at the start of each podcast, but we've swapped seats today for a reason, which I'll explain shortly. But firstly, though, I'm going to hand over to Julie to introduce our special guest.
Thank you for that, Helga. And we're just delighted today, and by popular request in the Parkinson's community, today we're going to be discussing all things speech and language therapy and what is happening in relation to research within this area. So Helga and myself are delighted to welcome Professor Anya Lowitt from the University of Strathclyde to the pod today. So a very warm welcome.
Thank you.
So Anya trained as a speech and language therapist at the University of Reading and has gradually been moving further north in her endeavours working as, within this area. So she then moved to the University of Newcastle, where she did her PhD on acoustic phonetic analysis of dysarthria, which in itself I think is quite a mouthful to get out in any one sentence. And currently, as I've mentioned already, Professor Lowitt works at the University of Strathclyde and is a member of the speech and language therapy team there. But really, part of the reason why Helga and I were so keen to have Professor Lowitt on the call today is her area of research really focuses on motor speech disorders. And a large proportion of her work is really focused on interdisciplinary approach, collaborating with a variety of different professionals, including engineers, computer scientists, psychologists, as well as NHS practitioners from across the NHS, including neurology and indeed other allied health professionals. So a huge warm welcome. And I'm going to hand back to Helga, my partner in crime, on the pod to get us started.
Thanks, Julie. I guess we all take speech for granted, but my voice was actually the thing I used to earn my living with. So it's been a big part of me for a large part of my life and also very much a part of my identity as well. I'd love to say I was a glorious opera singer, but it was nothing quite so fancy. Sadly not. I was a broadcast journalist on TV and radio. I'm used to having control over my voice and being able to articulate what I say, and the prospect of losing it in one way or another because of Parkinson's is not a nice one. So, Anya, I don't want to put pressure on you, but my hopes and fears are in your hands today. So, first of all, can you just tell us what exactly speech and language therapy encompasses?
Yes, so it's quite a wide field, and maybe it's easiest to start talking a bit more about how we actually produce language, because there's lots of different components and steps to it. So the thing that everybody can observe and that is most obvious to you is hearing your voice and how you're articulating the sound, and that's what we call speech. So this is, you know, you hear yourself, the other people hear you, and that can be affected. Like you said, Helga, your voice changes in its quality, it's maybe not as loud anymore, you don't change your pitch anymore as much as you used to, and the way that you're pronouncing the sounds can change as well. So this is what we refer to as speech. But before you actually say the sounds, say the sentence that you want to say, there's lots of other things that are going on as well, because you actually need to select what you want to say in the first place. You need to find the right words. You need to put them in the right order to get the grammar right. You need to make sure that you choose the right word for the context. You know, there's informal language, there's very formal language. So there's a lot of things, a lot of thinking processes that need to take place before you start kind of uttering the words that you want to say. And then again, you know, even when you get all that right, there's lots of other environmental factors that can affect how effective you can communicate with people. So, you know, are you on the phone or in a face-to-face situation? Are you in a noisy pub or in a quiet room at home? How sympathetic is your conversational partner? Do they cut in as soon as you need a little bit more time to say something, for example? So what a speech and language therapist does is they come and they would initially assess your voice and your speech, because, again, that is what's the kind of most prominent sign that you might have any issues. But then they kind of look at all the other factors as well. And they would then try and see how best to support that. And it might be things that you hadn't even thought of were relevant because they're not so noticeable to you. But the speech and language therapist will be able to identify what is the best strategy to support you as a communicator. And then the other quite important thing thing that we look after is swallowing. So when we eat and drink, there is things that are supposed to go down into the stomach, but initially that tube that takes your food and drink to the stomach also goes to your lungs. If it happens a lot, it might give you chest infections. Also, you need to, before you even swallow the food and drink, you need to kind of move it around in your mouth, and that can be an issue. You might start drooling because you don't close your lips quite so much. So I'm kind of preempting lots of things here. We can go into more detail, but this kind of gives you a kind of rough idea about what the speech language therapists do, hopefully.
I suppose from that, what are the optimal time that a person should see a speech and language therapist?
Yes, yeah. So with Parkinson's, the voice is usually the first sign that someone notices, both the person living with them, because all of a sudden the volume might drop and your voice, the quality of your voice might change. It's maybe become a little bit more breathy, not quite as strong as it used to be. In terms of when you go and speak to a speech and language therapist, there is a kind of school of thought that the earlier, the better. There's that kind of idea of, you know, use it or lose it. It's the same as, you know, we use muscles for speaking. And these muscles are no different to the muscles in your leg or your arm. They will experience the kind of same issues. And the more you can work them, the better. And the other thing is that if you go earlier and your speech is still quite good at that point, it's much easier to kind of learn some of the strategies that the speech and language therapist will try and help you with, rather than when you're already feeling sort of, you know, things aren't working quite so well. Quite often people, sort of researchers, think, you know, the earlier we can get in there, the better. But in reality, with the NHS, the pressures on the NHS workload, it doesn't always, therapists might see you maybe sort of just once and give you some general advice, but they wouldn't give you a full kind of treatment program, for example, and that would then, you know, that you would come back to them when things becoming a bit more serious. So ideally, we would like to give everybody a full program at the start, but it's quite often not feasible, and not everybody needs it either. So it's sort of very individual. The important thing is that as soon as you feel that some changes and things go worse, go back to the speech and language therapist, because they're kind of say, oh, you know, you'll be okay for 2 years. But then, you know, everybody is individual in terms of how quickly they progress. And also everybody is individual in how much their problems affect them. So we have people who are quite unintelligible, but are quite happy to just keep talking and socializing with everybody, whereas others have a minute problem with their voice that nobody actually picks up than themselves, and that really knocks their confidence, and they say, oh, I can't talk to people anymore. So again, it's important, if even if the therapist thing, you know, or the doctor thinks it's actually not that serious, get yourself referred, talk it over with a speech language therapist, and they can then decide the best course of action.
So what kind of interventions can a speech and language therapist then step in with?
So Parkinson's voice is quite an interesting phenomenon. So the way that, so the voice is produced by two muscles moving in and out against each other and vibrating, and that's creating your voice in itself. So what happens with voice in Parkinson's is that the quality changes, because the two muscles that are helping you produce the voice, again, don't function quite as well anymore. Quite often that results in people maybe straining their voice a little bit, or changing their pitch to a pitch that's not quite so good for voice production. And so the therapist can help with that, just giving you sort of voice techniques that makes producing the voice as effortless as possible. We're also looking, making sure that you've got enough breath. So there might be exercises to help you expand your lungs more, kind of breathing exercises to make sure you've got enough breath to produce the voice. And another very characteristic issue with the voice is that it drops in loudness. What is special in Parkinson's is that it's actually not a physical problem that's preventing you from speaking loudly, but it's something that the way you perceive your own voice, where you're thinking your voice is loud, but it's actually very quiet. And so it's a bit like a resetting that the therapist will work through with you to kind of help you perceive the actual loudness of your voice to make sure that you're speaking at that appropriate level. We can do exercise with speech. People kind of quite often use what we call a clear speech approach, where you sort of over-exaggerate the words, as if you're speaking to someone who's maybe slightly deaf and you sort of they're trying to lip read you. Again, that can help make your sounds clearer. And then, as I said, lots of environmental adjustments, just, you know, helping your communication partner understand how they can best support you, little strategies that help you when you get in a tricky situation where you can't get your message across.
Some of the symptoms that people with Parkinson's suffer, things like dystonia and hallucinations, can actually be side effects of the drugs rather than symptoms of the disease itself. Are speech and language or swallowing, drooling type problems, are these always the disease itself, or are any of them side effects of drugs too?
It tends to be the disease itself. There's been a lot of studies looking at whether levodopa has an impact on speech as a positive impact, and there isn't really any clear evidence. There is a few studies that recorded that people can be a little bit more dyskinetic with the levodopa, so that might have an impact on your speech, but generally it is actually disease itself. If anyone's thinking about deep brain stimulation, again, that can have a slightly negative impact on the speech, because it kind of depends on where the electrodes are placed. And in most cases, people get the deep brain stimulation to help with their movement. And that can have a slightly negative effect on the speech. If you were to kind of put it more where it helps the speech, then the movement wouldn't work quite so well. So it's kind of depends on what people's priorities are. But there's a lot of research going on at University College London and Queen's Square, who are kind of looking into that and how speech therapy can be added to the deep brain stimulation.
Do you know, it's really interesting when we talk about the impact of speech. So I think we've been very mindful. Last month we did a session on mental health, and we're very mindful of how anxiety and low mood is very prevalent amongst people with mm-hmm. Parkinson's. And while that is often as a result of the primary symptom of the condition, I think what you beautifully highlighted is actually impact on people's speech, and perhaps how that lowers confidence, self-esteem, self-efficacy, therefore often can make people withdraw from social events because they're worried mm-hmm. about whether they'll be heard, whether they'll be understood, or perhaps we're still misinterpreted. So it's interesting, mm-hmm. therefore, that actually some of the non-motor symptoms, as prevalent as they are, the speech problems can often reinforce those and mm-hmm. cause that as an addition. I suppose one thing that we're really mindful up here, particularly in the north of Scotland, but equally throughout Scotland, from a positive note, we've got lots of people who are part of Nosbrig who have been participating in singing groups, and they have seemed to be really positive, probably from a sort of mental health and well-being of coming together as a group and that, you know, co-support, camaraderie. Mm. I wonder if you could tell us why we think, from a research perspective, why singing is beneficial for Parkinson's.
Singing is a really interesting one. And I've kind of looked back through the literature, and the studies found that it works really well for communication, for speech, and other studies found that it didn't work. And I think it's just, again, you know, everybody's different, and it quite often maybe just depends on the group of people that you have in your study. So there's no clear evidence that it is beneficial for speech. But then I think what we need to kind of maybe take a step back and think, what do you actually mean by beneficial? Do we think, okay, does it increase the person's pronunciation of words? Maybe not. So what we need to look at is what kind of benefits we're actually looking for from the singing. So it might not affect how well we articulate the sounds, but it could help with how we're using our voice and how we're using the breath to produce the voice. It also, when we're singing, we're projecting our voice more, so it can help with the loudness. Maybe where we get in the inconsistent results is that some people might have had speech therapy before and others haven't. So I think having speech therapy already kind of teaches you the right techniques. It means you're using the voice properly while you're doing the singing. Whereas if you're coming to it fresh, it might not have quite so many benefits because you don't necessarily have the right techniques to help with that in kind of speech-related aspects. So I think singing is great. It's that communal aspect. You know, you're seeing other people, you're doing things together, and you're using the same muscles and mechanisms as you would for speech. But as I said, if we were doing doing it in a controlled study and looking for the outcomes that researchers look for, we might not necessarily find the benefits. So again, it's up to the individual. If they find it enjoyable, by all means, do it. It will be great for the mental health and it might help with the speech a little bit as well.
Thank you for that. I suppose that you almost had the million-dollar question in there that is probably a whole pod in itself. What are we defining as beneficial? I'm somebody who's always encouraging physical activity, but actually sometimes I do feel it's bringing people together. It's that opportunity to discuss with people in a similar situation than yourself that actually gives it the positivity. The fact that they're doing exercise alongside that can sometimes appear like a secondary benefit. And I think that engaging and immersing yourself in music or singing in itself is a real positive emotional enhancer. So whether it improves your speech per se or whether it has secondary benefits, as you say, on being able to take effective breaths, whether it has some postural potential benefits, it's difficult to say, but certainly it definitely kicks all those sort of feel good factors, doesn't it?
Definitely, it does, yes.
I suppose one thing that a lot of people I'm aware have had experiencing is participating in LSVT, so Lee Silverman Voice Therapy. I wonder if you could maybe just talk us through what LSVT is for those who aren't familiar with this speech and language therapy approach, and your sort of thoughts on the evidence behind this approach.
Yes, LSVT has been around since the late 90s, and they were really kind of pioneers in terms of doing controlled studies of the effects of the therapy. So when we kind of talk about gold standard of research evidence, then you should have a treatment that is compared with another treatment or no treatment at all, and people need to be randomized to it, and there needs to be lots and lots of control factors, which is quite difficult to do in clinical research, and you need lots of numbers as well. And so when we're looking at speech therapy, kind of the evidence for if a treatment is effective or not, there is not a lot there yet because people just haven't been able to do those studies. So LSVT was different because when you're looking at the publications from the LSVT team, it seems like it's better than all the therapies that they're comparing it with. There was a large study run in the UK called the PTCOM study, and they compared LSVT with what we call standard NHS therapy, which tends to be maybe a session or two sessions a week, whereas LSVT is very intensive. Unfortunately, we don't have the research results published from that yet, so I'm going to have to update you once they come out. The problem with the intensive treatment is that it's very difficult to offer within the clinical context in the NHS because you're basically taking up a therapist's week by having these four sessions. And so they can only take so many people on at a particular time. They have to kind of put blocks aside for it. And so it's a little bit more difficult to offer in the UK within the NHS environment, which is why the PDCOM study kind of wanted to look at how does it actually compare to that sort of slightly less intensive work that the therapist would normally offer traditionally here. The evidence, as I said, is positive so far compared to other types of treatment, which is in terms of what the LSVT team have produced. And we know from patient feedback that they kind of tend to find it beneficial. That where we're less clear is how long do the benefits last? And this is very much up to the individual, I think, how much practice they keep doing. So people maybe, we've had some reports, people need to come back after a year and get another course, and other people where it lasted longer. Again, evidence kind of suggests it's effective, but there's other studies who don't find it so effective. So again, it's a little bit inconclusive, like everything.
Absolutely. If people want to have a look at the PDCOM study, it's been run through the University of Birmingham, and you can access in the public domain. There's the research protocol has been published. If people want to read about it, about how it's comparing LSVT versus sort of standard sort of delivered NHS care. And it's really interesting. And we've touched about, we had a session on sort of research 101, and this is one of the challenges of research, isn't it? Because, is LSVT effective because it's delivered so intensively compared to standard, but it's that long-term impact, and can people maintain that the sort of voice exercises that are built into LSVT, and that becomes a challenge for people, and it becomes a challenge for NHS practitioners to deliver something four times a week for that 4-week period. It's quite an intense approach. So you've touched upon this in some of your answers already, but I wanted just to explore it in a little bit more focus. Is, you know, when we're, what are the challenges for speech and language therapists to conduct research? What you know, either from a methodological point of view or equally from a clinical hat on, and you kind of wear both of those hats, but what are the challenges and perhaps why don't we see a lot of speech and language therapist research being done?
Besides the big funding issue, which everybody is struggling with, it's clinical research. If you want to do it properly, it has to be very controlled. And so you'd have to kind of make sure that there sort of aren't any factors that could water down your results in the end, because I actually, you know, maybe it was because of something else that we're finding these results rather than the therapy that we've been providing. You need to do a lot of kind of background tests. So there's a lot of testing getting done in addition to the therapy. You usually have to compare therapy with something else or with no therapy. So there's kind of issues in terms of persuading participants to take part in it, because they might say, actually, I don't want to have this therapy, I wanted the other one, and I can't choose because I'm going to be randomized to something, or I don't want to have to wait 6 months before I can start with a therapy. So there's kind of issues in terms of people themselves wanting to take part in it. And the other big problem that we find is that most of the research is done with people quite early on in their disease, where the symptoms aren't so bad yet. And they're actually most of the time not as affected by it as those later on. But those later on, they've got so many things happening to them and they're fatigued and everything, is quite difficult to get them involved in the research. And therefore, the techniques that we've tried with the people at the early disease stages might not be that effective. And the other thing that is quite difficult is that people are so individual. And first of all, the symptoms they have, but also the response to the therapy, which means you need big numbers to be able to actually say this one works and this one doesn't. And as I maybe said earlier, you know, you're looking at a particular treatment, is it effective or not? And you get 50% of the studies that say yes, and the other 50% say no. And, you know, there are methodological differences. Maybe they're measured, you know, with different tests, which show slightly different things. But often I think it's just the luck of, you know, these people had a group that responded really well. And another study, the people maybe didn't find that treatment quite so engaging or as effective for them. And so it's that sort of individuality that always has an impact on the research, and is really important from a clinical point of view, because we can say LSVT is maybe the most effective treatment, but it might not work for the one person that you have in clinic. And therefore, you need to think about other ways of supporting them. So research is really important, because we need to know what works. The in sort of individually person-centered approach from a clinical point of view is very important as well.
Yeah, and I think people who've regularly listened to this pod, I think will really everything you've said will resonate with them. And I think that variation in the Parkinson's population, a lot of the methodological issues about standardization of research methodologies, using outcome measures that are sensitive to change when we actually deliver the intervention, these are common themes that are emerging from all researchers, and in some ways probably is what attracts researchers to being involved with Parkinson's, because it is complicated and it is a complex condition, but it does make it challenging if one wants to adopt a robust approach to research where we can get an answer, does this intervention work, yes or no, because you need to control for all those variables. So it's interesting to see how it affects research across the piece, and perhaps that's why, you know, we need to have, as you said, so many numbers, such large numbers involved in the sample to make sure that the statistical testing is robust. So part of these pods is trying to get people interested in research, so perhaps we can encourage more people from the Parkinson's community to get involved in research. So thank you for that. If I may, I'm going to have a bit of a gear change in the direction of the questions. So somebody has popped in a question, because Helga and I normally do and ask some of the questions, and they've asked whether speech and language decline in Parkinson's. Is there any evidence to support that that might be related to changes in cognition, or are these two separate entities? And that's a complicated question, I know.
It is, yes. So cognition is actually quite important to communication. Because I said earlier, you know, you need to think about the words that you want to say, order them in the right way. So you need cognition for that. But also just in a conversational situation, you know, when do you decide to come in and say something? How quickly does that happen? You need to pay attention. You need to kind of have the memory of what did the other people say. So you're constantly using your cognitive processes to communicate. And there was a systematic review that someone did a few years back, and they were looking at what we call communication participation. So how much do people with Parkinson's engage in communication with others? And there's a kind of few questionnaires that people can complete to indicate whether there is maybe a reduction in that. And when this person reviewed all the studies that had looked at communication participation, they found that that was actually more affected by cognitive decline than it was by speech, which I thought was very, very interesting. But it kind of shows the kind of central role of cognition. There's a few studies that are starting to suggest that cognition can have an impact on speech directly, mostly on kind of how many pauses you put, how long they are, how fast you speak, maybe. But mostly cognition is impacting on the sort of language aspect in terms of finding the right words quickly enough and so on. So there is a kind of general decline. I wouldn't say one is causing the other one necessarily. So maybe cognition and the kind of language aspects, if your cognition is poor, then your kind of word finding might be affected, for example. But there's sort of other linguistic issues that can be there without cognitive impairment. So again, it's a sort of very, very complex area, but they tend to go hand in hand along with disease progression.
What about facial masking? Is that linked to the speech and language therapy side of things, or is that just part of Parkinson's more generally?
I think, again, it's part of Parkinson's more generally. It's not going to have a big impact on your speech. I mean, your face will become more rigid, your facial muscles, and it might have a little impact on your lips. But it generally, I don't think it would have a great impact on how intelligible you are. It does have a big impact on your facial expressions, though, obviously. And when we are speaking, we're using gestures and we're using facial expressions to underlie what we are saying. And so there can be miscommunication because the facial expression doesn't quite express the same thing as what the person's trying to say. And if you combine that with maybe some slightly more monotonous voice as well, and a change in the kind of quality of the voice, it can impact on communication that way. And there's not a lot of kind of treatment evidence whether facial exercises can help it. But I think, again, it's just something where a speech and language therapist draw attention to it so that the person with Parkinson's will maybe focus more on that while they're speaking and make an effort to change. And also speaking with the partner, because partner training is a bit part of speech and language therapy as well, is making other people understand what problems the person with Parkinson's has and what that leads to and how they can support that. That would be an important part of our work as well. Yeah.
Super. So I'm going to take a big step into the future. And I suppose technology, we've been hearing about the pods, is starting to have a huge impact and a positive impact in many cases in healthcare. What do you see is the role of technology in things in relation to speech and language? And how do you think that could optimise or improve care for people with Parkinson's?
So yeah, there's some interesting developments happening. So one is kind of looking at speech features as a biomarker. People have found there are certain changes in your speech that are not obvious to the naked ear, but if we're doing some kind of acoustic analysis, we can notice that there are small changes. They could maybe sort of help towards a diagnostic process in future if they become researched more. And then also kind of looking at the disease progression. So what we're doing, you know, with someone maybe being seen every 6 months by the Parkinson's nurse, but maybe they need to come in a little bit earlier because things suddenly change more quickly. But they might not be aware of that. So if we have, you know, apps that sort of, you know, they take biometric measures, they look at how you're walking, but also how you're speaking, sort of taking a quick speech recording and analyzing that automatically and say, oh, actually, something's changing here. That could then send a signal to your medical team to say, maybe we should bring this person in and have a look at the meds again. It needs a lot more development for this to work properly. But I think people are kind of working in that area quite a lot. There's a lot of engineers that are looking at sort of automatic analysis of speech, which is necessary for that. There is some development, which isn't necessarily good for treatment, but there are projects where, you know, all the voice apps like Alexa and so on are being trained to become better with less intelligible speech. And so there might be much more apps that can be used to support people in their daily life, because it's, you know, they can say what they need and the app picks it up and does things for them. So that's one other area. But then again, kind of come back to treatment, I think the sort of whole area of telehealth is going to become much more prolific through the NHS as well. I mean, with COVID, it had a good start. It will be able to reach people in the more rural communities that kind of can't travel in, and also kind of develop that peer support. So I did a study, not with Parkinson's, but people with ataxia, and we started during COVID when they felt their speech was becoming worse because they couldn't socialise quite as much and they didn't have quite so many opportunities to speak. And so we set up a group therapy program where they all met online. And that was really, really positive, that peer support, because it was actually, we put the groups without the therapist. So they met 5 days a week and the therapist only joined once a week to kind of check how everybody was going. And they worked together through a manual of exercises. And they really, really appreciated that peer support. And some of those groups are still meeting now. So I know technology and using the technology can be a bit of a barrier for people, but if they're properly supported, everybody could actually work them in the end, and kind of building that community and support again kind of helps with quality of life, mental well-being, and can help the communication as well.
I think that's what's really come across for me in this, is that speech and language therapy and issues don't seem to get talked about so much as we hear about the tremor, we hear about the bradykinesia, the dystonia. But actually, it's a huge part of us, a huge part of our identity, our daily function, something we very much take for granted. Yeah. And just to see that the focus and also the, as you've mentioned, the many ways in which technology might be able to help us in this, it is very promising.
Yeah, definitely.
Anya, thank you very much indeed. That's been absolutely fascinating. And as I say, you know, for someone who has used their voice as their job and someone who's taken that very for granted, you know, it's been a great amount of food for thought.
Thanks very much again for inviting me and sharing this.
Huge thank you both for your insights, your expertise and your time today. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.